radioalbion.com.
Well, that's the round table. We dance where we're able. We do routines and corner scenes to footwork in bed cable. We dine well here in Camelot. We eat ham and jam and spam a lot.
Hello and welcome to the Radio Albion Roundtable. Today's date is Monday the 23rd of February 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Once again, we have a roundtable. We haven't had one of these since Christmas time, I think, and that was very, very well received. And, of course, it means I have two co-hosts with me today, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and Grandpa Lampshade. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderfully, now that I just discovered that the real voice of Cletus T. Judd is absolutely Grandpa Lampshade. I had no idea that this country music superstar actually lived down south. I had no clue. I'm very excited. I'm honored, actually.
Well, I've never heard of him, but I'm sure Grandpa will be honored to hear that. Grandpa, how are you doing today?
It's like the dream team here, all back together. I guess I'm known as many things. I've even been accused of being actually Sven Longshanks. We're the same person. So, you know, I guess I'm good with it. I'll just roll with it. And now I'm going to have to look up, see who this person is.
I think we'll all have to. I got a suspicion he may not be quite up to the heroic caliber of the people that we're going to be discussing today. As always with the roundtable.
I am personally outraged that you guys don't know who Cletus T. Judd is. I just want to state that right now.
I'm extremely upset. No idea at all. Anyway, as I say, we've got three stories that we're each going to be bringing to the table today about heroes of our age. The first one. is a bit of a continuation from last week's Area in Britannia, where me and Max Musson were discussing Ernest Shackleton's Trans-Antarctic Expedition, which had all sorts of terrible things go wrong in it. And we finished doing that last week, and I watched a documentary about this, and I was just amazed at actually what they went through. And there were lots of details in this documentary that didn't actually come out in the talk last week. And also it concentrated on Captain Worsley as well, who was from New Zealand, because we were doing it as part of our Greatest Britain series and can't really talk about somebody from New Zealand as being a Great Britain, but obviously he was originally English. So I thought what I would do is go into some of the details of this expedition that I wasn't able to get into last week. And the first thing that I wasn't aware of when we were talking about it is the fact that it was all filmed. They brought cameramen on this expedition, which is basically going from one end of the Antarctic to the other across the continent with passing the pole in the middle. The pole had only just been discovered. Captain Scott had just died out there. And this was in the age of heroic Antarctic expeditions, when they didn't have the clothing that we have now, they didn't have the technology that we have now, but they did actually have cameras. It was a new technology, cameras and movie cameras, and they had a cameraman on along with them on the expedition, and he filmed everything. The photos are absolutely glorious. Obviously, they're in black and white, but it gives you a real idea of what actually went on. Now, I discussed Ernest Shackleton's life last week and how he had struggled to get the money together for this expedition. And then no sooner had they set off on the expedition, and he had 28 men with him, than the ship that they were in, it got stuck in the ice and they had to disembark from the ship. And last week we said they may have sort of cannibalized the ship. We weren't quite sure how they did this. And basically, they got right out of the ship. They were on the ice. They put tents up. They were playing football, of course. Captain Worsley was taking snow baths on the ice. And their morale was really high, and they were really chipper. And we were sort of questioning what it was that they ate. And there were lots of seals and penguins that were around. And they had wood and they had coal. So they were able to cook their food. So they had hot food. They had lots of dogs there with them. They even had a ship's cat with them. And everybody really loved the dogs, and the dogs really helped to keep their morale up. And they were like this for a year. They were on this ice before the ship eventually went down, and their luck really took a turn for the worst after that. The seals and the penguins, they disappeared, and there wasn't enough food for themselves and also the animals. So the first animal that was to be killed was the cat. After that, it was the dogs. And Captain Worsley wasn't very happy about that, that this cat had to be killed, and it was the first pet to be killed because it was his favorite pet. And there was a bit of an atmosphere between the two of them after that. And we went into that a little bit last week, and that's why Captain Worsley is taken with him later on when they're in their lifeboats, which I'll get into, because they had these three lifeboats with them. And as after the ship went down, they decided, or Ernest Shackleton decided, that what they would do is they would try to drag the three lifeboats over the ice right to the end of this ice floe that they were on, and then they would head off from there. And it took them 3 days to move these lifeboats just 1.5 miles. And they had to just abort this mission. It was impossible to do. So they made camp again. And then the ice floe that they were on started to break up, and it started to break off into pieces. And they haven't got their ship there anymore. That's sunk, basically. And all they've got is these lifeboats. And they decided, right, well, what we're going to do is we're going to put out to sea. And we're going to head for this island, which was called Elephant Island. So they pushed off in these lifeboats, and it actually took them a week to get to Elephant Island. And you think they're actually in the roughest seas in the world, and they're in these little 22-foot boats, three of them, with oars, and they got a sail. And they had no water by this time, so they were chewing raw seal meat in order to get the liquid out from this meat. And Captain Worsley, who was at the helm of the main lifeboat, he was leading the way. For 40 hours non-stop, he was at the helm on the ship's wheel. And at one point, he had to be prized away from it after this 40 hours. And the ship's men literally had to fold him into a sleeping shape, because he was just frozen rigid at the ship's wheel there. He went 90 hours without sleep at one point. And then when he did fall asleep, he had to be kicked in the head to wake him up afterwards. They must have been quite worried about this. He was, you know, just out for the count. Eventually, they got to this Elephant Island, and it was the first time that they had actually had proper earth under their feet for well over a year. And what they decided to do once they got there, Ernest Shackleton decided that he would leave most of the men there. He would leave 22 of the men there, and just 6 of them would head 800 miles to this island, which was called South Georgia. And they would make that in this one lifeboat with a sail. So they modified the lifeboat. The carpenter chopped up the other lifeboats. They got loads of rocks that they were going to put in there as ballast. And I'm just thinking there, I said that it was it was Captain Worsley who was upset with the cat. I mean, it may have been the carpenter. It was either the carpenter or Captain Worsley that wasn't happy about this cat being killed. And the carpenter was actually taken on the lifeboat with them, because they didn't want him to be left there with these men, because that would have affected their morale. They would have got all upset, because the amazing thing about this is that they managed to keep their chipper up the whole time that this was happening. None of them were like, oh no, this is the end of the world. Nobody knows where we are. Nobody's going to rescue us. Everybody remained cheerful the whole way. So these 6 men then struck out to sea, heading for South Georgia, this tiny little island in the middle of the ocean, 800 miles away, in the roughest sea on earth, in this 22-foot boat. And they went 3 days without seeing the sun. And this is really important, because the only way they could navigate was by the sun, with a sextant, which is a very hard way of navigating. It's a very old way of doing it. It was an absolute miracle that he was able to do this. They only had 4 sightings in the entire 16 days, and yet Captain Worsley was able to use his sextant and work out where they were going. And I've got a quote from him. He said he would catch the sun when the boat leaped her highest on the crest of a sea. And you imagine that just 4 times he was actually able to do that. And to find this little island in the middle of the ocean, in the roughest seas in the world, in a little 22-foot boat, is just incredible. It was so cold that they could only lie on the decks for 5 minutes at a time or they would freeze. And when they were lying on the deck, it was on all these rocks that they had put in for ballast. They did have some warmth last week. I was wondering whether they had any heater on the boat at all. They did have kerosene with them. And what they did, they had hot milk, meat and fat, which they would drink. Now, I don't know where they got the milk from, and possibly seal milk or something like that. Eventually, they got to the island. And when they got there, there was hurricane force winds. And these hurricane force winds were so much that a 500 ton steamer that was in the area sank in this storm. And because of the way the winds were going, they couldn't land on the shore. So they had to spend 2 days in right up close to the island, with fantastic skillmanship to not get bashed on these rocks in this little boat, just paddling to keep themselves away from the biggest waves, and also to prevent the currents taking them past this island, because if they went past it, that would be it. They would be stuck. There would be no way that they could actually get back to it. And once the hurricane force winds had gone down, they landed on the shore and then realized that the whaling station was on the other side of the island, because they were hoping to get to this whaling station. So Captain Worsley and Ernest Shackleton decided what they would do is they would leave 3 men there on that side of the island, and the other 3 would work their way over the top. And it was a mountain range that had never been crossed before in the middle of the Antarctic. So absolutely freezing cold, with a mountain range that they had no idea what they were going to actually come across. And the 3 of them decided to do it. And all they had was a 50-foot piece of rope. They put screws into their boots and they had this this little bit of kerosene with them and this little bit of liquid that they had. And they had to stop every 20 minutes to rest by this time. And they would stop for 15 minutes. And at one point, Captain Worsley got so frightened that the rest of them wouldn't wake up that he got them to wake up after 5 minutes, because he thought if they go for any longer, they're just going to give up the ghost and I'll be left here on my own. Halfway across this mountain range, they ran out of kerosene, completely ran out of kerosene. So by this time they'd run out of food. They also, when they set off on this trip, they only allowed themselves a certain amount of food, because they said if it lasts any longer than this time, you know, that's it. We're going to die. And they promised the other 22 members of the crew that they're going to make it to this island and they're going to make it back for them. And eventually they get to a really steep precipice and they coiled the rope up and just used it as a sled. They sort of skied down this precipice. And then eventually they heard the whaling siren of the Stromness whaling station, which was basically calling all the sailors to work. And they followed this siren. And eventually they got there. It was a 36-hour march over the mountains that they had made. And 17 months they had actually been stranded in the Antarctic by this time. And the first thing they did was get straight into a boat and head off to rescue his men on the other side of the island, because he's got the 3 men on the other side of the island. And then they waited for 3 days. They rested for 3 days. And then they took off to try and find the others on Elephant Island in a hired ship. But the ice stopped them 60 miles away from where they wanted to get to. It was the same situation that they were in with the Endurance at first, which was the big ship that got stuck in the ice and then got broken by the ice, basically. So then they headed to the Falklands to try and get another ship, and that failed as well. Uruguay lent them a ship, but again, the ice was too much, although they did get within sight of Elephant Island by this time. Next, they went to Argentina, and Argentina lent them a vessel, and that also failed. And this is in the middle of the First World War as well. I mean, thankfully, Britain was on good terms with these South American countries and was saying, look, can you help these guys out to go and rescue their men? Finally, Chile offered a steel-hulled ship to them, and eventually they got there. And they got to Elephant Island and they found all 22 men still alive. They still had that hope in Shackleton and Worsley. And it actually took them 4 months to finally get there to rescue them. And they all managed to make it home. And it was 17 months it was. in all, like over a year and a half spent in these frozen, icy wastes. And it was only the faith that they had in Shackleton that kept them alive, that he would ensure that they survived. And every one of them did. And it was just an absolute miracle that they did. You think what they went through, frozen to the mast in the, you know, the roughest seas that there are in the world. And, you know, that's the sort of heroic character that white men have, I think. It really shows absolute courage here and commitment and honor and loyalty to your men. And, you know, just setting your mind to something, setting your will to something and achieving it. And I just think it's incredible. What do you guys think of it? What do you think of that, Matt?
Well, you may not know this, but there is a rock band called the Shackletons from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, where I lived for 10, 12 years. Their guitar player was my son's guitar teacher, and they're named after Ernest Shackleton and his crew. On this, and he explained to me, and I went to grammar school, to grade school with a Shackleton family. They spell it differently, but he was the first one to ever explain to me this situation. And so, you know, that's, I didn't even make the connection when you said you were going to talk about the Shackletons. They are Irishmen. Don't forget, Ernest Shackleton is from County Kildare. So something that bugs me about it is every once in a while I look this up, at least Ernest, and the Guardian did a very bad, I want to say hatchet job on the guy. I forget the year. And essentially what they said is that, he was an adventurer. He's looking for a get rich quick scheme. You know, he'd been down there many times, looking for gold, looking for, you know, whatever would get him wealthy. It was May of 99. They came out with it. It's actually a book review. And, you know, it's there's been some hatchet jobs in the guy because, you know, and claiming that his heroism is, well, real, had more to do with his own, you know, get rich quick schemes and everything else. I think his brother was accused of taking the Irish crown jewels, and I think he was exonerated from that. Just, you know, his family always was involved in things like that. And, but what is, I have a question for you though. What is the connection between Shackleton's, explorations and the Falkland Islands?
I think that's just on the route to get there, isn't it? In, Argentina, it's just off the edge of Argentina. And that was part of the route on the way to get to the Antarctic. They would head off to Argentina, and then from there they would make their way to the ice floes. That's the connection.
Well, what I mean is, well, the economic connection. You know, why is the Falkland Islands so important to Britain economically speaking, and is this connected with what Shackleton discovered and the things that he was doing down there?
I don't think he discovered anything. I think it was his idea to go on this expedition. I mean, he first went on an expedition with Captain Scott. I mean, he became a navalman and just happened to get on this expedition. And I think he actually struggled at one point, and he was unable to make it right the way to whatever it was they were doing. And then when he got back, because he'd had this experience, he wanted to do it again. He wanted to be the first person to get to the South Pole, because this was the last continent of the world that had yet to be mapped. Nobody had got to the South Pole yet. Nobody had actually worked their way right the way across it. That's what he was doing it for, was to be the first man in the world to do this. These were the last things that we had left to do before setting foot on the moon, I guess. That was the point of it. And he had to get funds in order to do this. And obviously he had this photographer there to photograph everything, and they were mapping everything as well. But it's not like it was paid for by a scientific exploration organization. It was paid for by private financiers, and what they would get places named after them. They would get ships named after them. They would be named as the sponsors of this expedition, and they would go down in history for that reason. And that was the selling point for it. I don't think there was this idea of, you know, he was going to find gold down there or anything ridiculous like that in the ice. I mean, it's just a frozen wasteland there. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I'm really going by this book review really bothered me because it just takes every negative aspect of a guy's personality, someone who would do something like that, and explode it. And you know, really, and he makes that accusation that this is a something for his own ego to get rich quick scheme. He's gonna try to find something. You know, he's gonna be wealthy. That's what these investors were giving money for, and he's egomaniac, and this is his fault. You know, the boat was too small. He was not a professional in any of these areas. He was an amateur. But they do say, despite these kind of attacks on him, they do say that he was an expert in keeping everybody happy. So apparently, regardless of any other what else about him, they actually have to admit that he was someone who had that skill. He could take any situation and make it good.
Well, you can counter all that criticism by saying, well, he succeeded in rescuing all his men, and he kept them all alive, and that was the most important thing. Grandpa, had you heard of this before, this expedition? What do you think of this superhuman feat of I don't know what the word is, a superhuman feat of stamina, I guess?
Well, I can see why the modern world would essentially start trying to tear this guy down. Because this is just classic white people. I mean, really, you look at this. This is what white people are meant to do. I think this is one of the reasons we find ourselves basically so lost in this modern world. I mean, only white people would get on a wooden boat and decide, let's just go down there because nobody has before. I mean, it's what it comes down to. Let's just get on this boat and go on this adventure. I mean, yeah, they have to find financial sponsors and things such as that. But trying to make it, oh, well, they were just doing it for the money. That is just a modern spin, because people anymore don't do anything unless there's money involved. But this whole story is just so classic white people. This is what no other race of people would say, hey, let's go sail down here, risk our lives to check out this giant frozen wasteland. Well, why? Because nobody else has done it before. What other reason do you need? Not surprised that it's so often the case in the modern world. They feel this necessity to tearing these things down. We can't have anything that's considered great. But no, this is just classic. This is just how white people are. Only white people would want to go do this. I was looking at some of these details as you went through the story and putting the, you know, modern day spin on it. You see the ice flow broke up because of the global warming, because they were destroying the planet. You see, they were actually destroying nature by going down there, and they survived how? By eating seals. They were seal clubbing. Think of the poor baby seals. They didn't survive, Sven. But what about their lives? Don't seal lives matter too? Because we live, of course, in clown world. So people become so effeminate, and you know, our society is so feminized and become so feminine in nature, that when people see or hear about or read a story such as this, which is just so masculine, white male centered, they have no way to identify with it. They can't understand it. They can't understand the concept of why a group of guys would risk their lives to go do something like this when there really doesn't, you know, really when it comes down to it, it's just purely for the adventure of it. They can't understand it. Well, that must have been for money. It must have been some kind of get rich quick scheme. They have to try to put this, they have to view it through some kind of modern lens, because people have lost the ability to grasp that. As to the survival of it, I mean, this just shows how people are tougher than they once were. And I it is amazing, because you know, you say, well, the morale was high. But at the end of the day, the people, the men involved here, had to make a conscious decision. You're either going to get up tomorrow and face that day and figure out what can you do today to survive. Well, we've got meat right now. And sit around and worry about, man, what are we going to do if we're 6 months from now and we're still struck? They didn't worry about that. They faced each day as it came and tried to figure out a way. Okay, well, let's try this. We'll drag these boats across here. Well, that didn't work. A lot of a significant percentage of the population at that point would have just said hell with it. I mean, once you make up in your mind, you don't care anymore, I'll just die, I just give up, then you're done for. put these guys. Okay, well, that didn't work. What next? Okay, well, let's figure out our next plan. You know, we're alive now, so we've got hope. And just keep doing that day by day, step by step. They overcame these insurmountable odds. You look back at it, and it took all these months from beginning to end, this survival story. But they never looked at it that way. At the beginning of this, if somebody would have said, hey, look, you know, this is going to be over a year out here. I mean, they probably would have been, a bunch of them would have probably been like, what? You know, no way. But they didn't look at it that way. They looked at it as we're live today. What can we do tomorrow to figure out a way to better our situation? And they took that day by day by day and survived. And in the end, they came out of it. They came out of it with a magnificent story. And but they did. They took it day by day. They made the conscious decision to survive. People today can't understand that. They can't grasp that. People are ready to give up. They're ready to lay down and die. Like if the electricity goes off longer than 6 hours, yeah, I'm being a little over the top with that, but we're not far from it. If you took away people's cell phones, heck, half of them would probably kill themselves. You know, if you said you can't have a cell phone anymore, you know, within a day, they can't post on social media, they're going to go off themselves. It was a whole different time and a whole different society. And people were just tougher. But the whole story, it just, again, to get back to the beginning of my point, is that this is just classic. This whole story is classic white people. Only white people would decide to go off on this grand adventure. It doesn't matter. They're risking their lives. Who cares? Why? Because nobody else has done it.
I think only white people would have the stamina and the strength of purpose and the willpower as well. And none of them lost their temper in that whole time. Not one of them lost their temper because they knew how that would damage the group's morale. It's just an incredible story, I think.
I want to agree with Grandpa 100%. In no way was I accepting these attacks. In fact, I was bringing it up for the sake of making a similar point. I mean, postmodern man, we read about the Germans freezing in the east on the Eastern Front, or these guys or any of these kind of endurance. You know, there's no context for it in the postmodern world, and certainly people writing in 1999 here, there's no context for it. Why would anyone do it? But there has to be money, it has to be power. He has to be promoting himself. And Grandpa's 100% correct here.
Yeah, just doing it because nobody else had done it. Matt, what have you got for us today?
Well, something a bit more mundane, a bit more political. I'm glad you brought up the Shackletons. It's been a long time since I thought of them. But I want to talk about Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary. You know, for a very long time, Hungary and Russia were at odds. They were opponents. The revolution of 1848, the monarchy, the Austrian-Hungarian monarchy was overthrown, and an invasion by Emperor Nicholas I put the emperor back on the throne again. In other words, they had an empire because of Russia, and they immediately sided with all of Russia's enemies as a reward, and never once supported Russia in anything. And the Hungarian Russian mutual contempt has been around at least since then. But that's changing. And what's happening is that in the war against globalization, in the war, which is just liberalism, you know, at a corporate board meeting, that's a good line, by the way. That's a good meme. Globalization is liberalism in a corporate board meeting. Because that's really what it is. It's just the economic version of it over, you know, trying to create a one world to lower transaction costs and lower wages. In this war, people who used to be enemies now realize that they have far bigger fish to fry. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which I've said for a long time is the most important anti-globalist institution out there, founded by Russia and China, directly against. When you say Western or liberal, I'm sorry, Western or American, you mean liberal. I'm not talking about, when I say Western, I'm not talking about Plato. I mean, you know, the liberal corporate agenda. So sometimes I do get into trouble when he says Western. He's not talking about, you know, Hegel. He's talking about the postmodern multinational corporation. They brought together India and Pakistan, who had been at war for a very long time. But given the economic success of these countries, the Silk Road, and the need to oppose liberalism, they've now come together. Well, you have two groups of enemies now also in Europe coming together, Poland and Russia and Hungary and Russia. And it's over, of course, the European Union, which is just a mini version of globalization, and specifically the migrant attack on Europe. They've been wars going on for a long time in the so-called developing world. But never before have we had this organized train of migrants in huge numbers being brought in an orderly fashion into European society. This is a bizarre, brand new – I shouldn't say it's a brand new phenomenon, because it's – you know, when Stalin used to force Russians to go and settle in Ukraine to make it more Russian, it's the same concept, resettling people. They did it in Ireland with the Scottish Highlanders and the so-called replacement that the British elites engaged in throughout the colonial period in Ireland. It's typical population transfer, and it's done for these reasons. And it's done to control and to dominate. And it you know, but as far as it being expressed to the world as this random phenomenon brought about by one war in Syria, you know, that's a completely different thing. We're talking about men, and it's almost always men, in the millions, usually of you know, military age, being brought on boats that somehow materialize out of nowhere, I guess, and bring them to Europe's shores. Now, the claim, of course, is that European populations are not reproducing themselves. Now, while I have volunteered myself to assist in the demographic crisis as much as possible, no one's really taken me up on that, at least not in many years. But, you know, I'm only one man, you know. But because of this, they claim that we need these third worlders to take their place, because the alternative is unthinkable. The alternative, of course, is that wages might go up. Now, Orban just last month gave his State of the Union address. And I want to say it's really – I mean, Putin's State of the Unions are really good, you know, but they're tame. You know, he's a diplomat. This guy doesn't care anymore. He knows they're after him. He knows they're going to destroy him, or they're going to try to. He knows he can't satisfy them. So he comes right out and says it. And – his main target – now, this is a State of the Union address. His main target is George Soros. Now, I want to make it clear that George Soros is a symbol. All major corporations have foundations that give to liberal causes. They all do it. I mean, Goldman Sachs probably is easily just as politically involved as Soros is. I think Soros, given his age, he's at the end of his career, he doesn't care. He'll put his face as the symbol of corporate liberalism. But it's not just him. Now, because this is Hungary and he's a Jew from Hungary, it's more important. But in general, we say Soros, that we just mean corporate capital dictating politics. All NGOs are corporate. That's where they get their money from. You go to any of their web pages, they usually have a section called partners, and it'll be a list of corporations. It gets to all the homosexual groups. It's all corporate capital. And so these NGOs are essentially the political arm of corporations, especially banks. And one of the lines that Orban says in his speech, he says, "It's my conviction that there is no such thing as a liberal. A liberal is nothing more than a communist with a university degree." And then he says, "If we had taken their advice, right now, Hungary would be in the intensive care ward with the tubes of the IMF and Brussels credit attached to every limb. And the fingers on the valves regulating the flow of credit would belong to George Soros." Now, of course, given the fact that Soros is from Hungary, he has a particular interest in it. And in his speech, he says Soros has tried to plunder Hungary on three separate occasions. The first time, we all know what happened in the 1990s. No one was sad to see the Soviet Empire go. What took its place, though, was at least as bad. And the massive debt that these countries went into were, of course, owned by somebody. George Soros attempted to buy all of Hungary's state debt in the early 90s. And it was the Prime Minister Joseph Antal who had to step in and keep this from happening. And Orban says it's a spine-chilling to even think of the implications of having an entire country's debt owned by one person. Then in 94, he tried to plunder us a second time. He tried to buy OTP Bank, which was the single, the big retail bank of the place. So then after, and then he, much of Hungary's debt back then was owned by Soros, but not all of it. Then OTP Bank was the, essentially the central bank at the time, at least in the private sector. And that would then put all of Hungary's money in the hands of one person. And then that was Gulia Horn who kept that from occurring. But then he says the third one was the worst of all. That is 2015. He calls it people smuggling networks disguised as human rights organizations. They're bringing hundreds of migrants to the Hungarian border. Now understand, we've spoken about, Poland in this case. They settle migrants all the time. Real actual refugees. Now when the Ukrainian civil war took off in 2014, Hungary and Poland took many actual refugees in. And in the Polish case, Brussels said, no, they're the wrong color. And as far as I could see, the translation actually is that. They're the wrong color. This isn't about taking care of refugees. This is about changing the nature of your societies. And he makes this very clear. He says, and when Europe was already straining under the weight of migration, Soros announced that he was ready to offer credit to finance the settlement of 1 million migrants a year. And he says, by the way, that this is still on the agenda. He said, we must, this operation is in progress and we must maintain the defenses stoutly and unwaveringly. But it's more than just talk. We've spoken about Poland on this show, less so Hungary, but it's actually worked. In 2011, the New York Times went orbital when Orban took over the central bank. This was the origin of him being authoritarian. The media uses words like authoritarian. Remember, the media have no obligation to educate you. They're not experts in political theory, even foreign affairs. They're journalists. They have an agenda. They do what they're told. I want to stress, and I'll say this over and over again, issue-oriented politics, the way that CNN did, that's how they package things. That's not politics. That's not power. That's not how things are. The fact that the media may create a marketing soundbite by talking about an issue, packaging it in a certain way, it doesn't mean it's actually real. So a term like authoritarian means, and this is where it got started, because this is a way to protect their investments. Authoritarian means somebody who will essentially kick George Soros out of the country. Russia did it many years ago. And just like Putin, Orban, by the way, a big admirer of Putin, they both paid off their state debt. In Russia's case, it was early, which they tried to stop. Hungary was quite on time. But despite the massive economic success of Hungary, the big credit rating agencies like, S&P and Moody's, they're very politicized. They downgraded Hungary's bonds to junk status, below investment grade. Despite the fact that the country was very healthy economically, but that was their protest. That's how they're going to attempt to control their, and it's the same people, of course, controlling their interest in the state bank. The former prime minister, Ferenc Gyurcsány, was the symbol of this cosmopolitan liberal scumbag. He's one of the richest men in Hungary. He's close to Soros. He was kind of the foil to Orban, a former communist who immediately in 1990 suddenly ends up being a major financial consultant. He was a director of Eurocorp International Finance. Then he was the CEO of Altus Limited. It's amazing how these guys go from the Communist Party and talking about, you know, Lenin to the next day, almost literally the next day, working for Altus or Eurocorp or Creditum Financial Consulting Limited. And by 2002, he was the fifth richest person in Hungary. But in 2006, he made a speech. It was meant to be a secret speech to his Socialist Party. And what he said is that it's all phony. Now, I've read this thing. It's on Wikipedia. It's in a bunch of places. The translation is iffy because he uses a lot of curse words. He uses the F word all the time. And he says we're frauds. He says we don't do anything because we're in the service of somebody else. We are, you know, we serve ourselves and that is it. We have done nothing and that's our job. Well, it wasn't supposed to get out. And when that speech got out, there were riots in Budapest. I think if that happened in America, you know, we shrug our shoulders. No kidding. In Hungary, it was a different story. This guy, you know, he's been married like four times. He's an atheist. You know, of course, he speaks perfect English. He plagiarized his master's thesis. You know, it's classic, you know, typical, more American than Hungarian. And when he made that speech, this is one of the things that propelled Orban and his party into power. But as the credit rating agencies are lowering their bond status to junk bond status, government debt has been wiped out. Economic growth almost quadrupled. Wages went up 10%. Poverty massively decreased. And there's another measure, you know, destitution, extreme poverty, fell by almost half. Unemployment has fallen by nearly two-thirds. His party, Fidesz, created, you know, public works projects, especially in rural areas. He sought national control of important sectors, rejects globalization entirely. He demanded a rise in the minimum wage, which, by the way, doubled under his tenure. And with all this, wealth inequality in Hungary is the lowest in the European Union. 79, you know, percent difference between the richest and the poorest in Austria. It's 45% in Hungary. He also has a flat tax, which he took from Putin. Now, more recently, he says in his speech, actually, he's talking about the investments that the, you know, whenever you have a populist movement come in, the Chinese invest because they like this kind of thing. This is why they're politically, you know, allied with us. 101 large investments, in other words, big ticket items. Russia has the same thing in Crimea and elsewhere, from China and Russia. And he calls it the policy of eastward opening. And in 2019, they broke all Hungarian export records. And this is one of the reasons that he's under attack. Refusing the migrants, attacking Soros in his State of the Union address at some length, and making statements like in 2018, he said, we must state that we don't want to be a diverse country and we don't want to be mixed. We do not want our own color traditions and national color traditions and natural culture to be mixed with those of others. We don't want this. We don't want this at all. We don't want diversity. He says, you know, he has a preference for racially homogenous society. And the Constitution has been modified to make it illegal to settle foreign populations there. Now, like all of these movements and people, and you know, we've talked about this too, is the rebuilding of the family. Now, the Hungarian thing is a little different. Over 100,000 people have received loans, which you get when you're pregnant, a family, a woman is pregnant. And he has a special, almost affirmative action program for those in small towns, building these small towns and provincial cities. Only 18% is actually in the capital. And he says there's an explosion of babies. In fact, he says dealers are having difficulty meeting the demand for large family-sized cars. And same thing for baby cribs. They have an income tax exemption for mothers with four or more children. And the state has bought private sector infertility clinics. And they did that because they want to make that kind of medication free to everybody. And so, you know, it's still not where it should be yet. But there are millions of kids born that would not have been. He also says that the number of marriages has surged upwards and they're at a record low for divorce, and the number of miscarriages is declining at a historic low. So these are kind of the things that, you know, he sweeps every election. And so that they can't stop him. But we all know what the word democracy means to our enemies. It has nothing to do with voting or referenda or civil rights. It has to do with the domination of the leftist press. And like everybody else, you know, he realizes that Russia is a leader of this movement. China is a big economic part of it. And he, of course, refers to the great replacement idea. And he says, if we let tens of millions of migrants travel to Europe from Africa and the Middle East, the young people of Western Europe will know the day when they will be a minority in their own country. And he's been attacked under the New York Times, has called him a Hitlerian and everything else, all the same classical insults. So you see these populist movements also have the same agenda. They have the same sponsor in Russia. They have the same economic sponsor in China. Understand, you know, in my talk I did on national corporatism, this is China's system now. It's has more to do with, say, the Third Reich than it does Mao. Mao's system has been jettisoned. You have these guilds, they're, you know, not guilds, but you know, corporations, unions that represent labor. And Hong Kong is very similar in that respect. And they're all very similar. He refers to himself as an illiberal Democrat. That democracy needn't be liberal because liberalism is all about money. And so that's my hero for the day. I think it was important in the fall of communism. He founded his party in 1988 when it was illegal. He's certainly he's one of our people, and it's worth praising. He does like Israel, but hey, no one's perfect.
So he's basically compensated for what the EU is saying. We need to bring in people from the outside to replace the people that aren't being born in Europe. What he's actually done is the unthinkable, and encouraged Hungarians to produce more Hungarians by giving free income tax for life to the women who have four children, and by giving out loans, and as you say there, the infertility clinics. I mean, he's quite an incredible chap. And I think he was physically involved in overthrowing the Soviets as well. He was took a large part in the revolution that overthrew the Soviets back in the 90s there. Yeah, he's quite an incredible character, and also very, very forthright about his Christian views as well, and that Hungary needs to stay Christian. Grandpa, have you got any views on Viktor Orban there, or on what Matt had to say there?
Well, it really does shine the light on this lie of their excuse that the reason they're importing the third world is because, you know, oh, well, because population decline. I mean, it's a bogus argument from the get-go, but this really shines a light that, you know, look, these things aren't that complicated to solve. Of course, as Dr. Johnson pointed out, you know, it always comes down to we can't have wages rising. You know, we can't have an upward pressure on the cost of labor. They always want to keep the labor. This is all part of living in the corporatocracy. The thing I thought is worth focusing back on real quick is this notion of the debt and paying the debt off, and why, you know, because I think the average listener, you know, hears this, you know, well, they got their bonds rated to junk bond status after basically paying off all their debt. And it kind of like doesn't compute for the average person. It does. It seems like a contradiction. But people just don't understand, I think, you know, why debt is such a powerful tool. You know, the biblical principle of the borrower is subject to the lender applies to nations as well as it does to individual people. If you are the borrower, the lender has authority over you, much more so if it's, you know, you have to borrow the money to survive. This is their way of keeping control. You're not supposed to pay the debt off. When you hear about nations owing huge amounts of money, people think, wow, these banks have really got themselves into a pickle now, because, you know, the IMF is in a real pickle because Greece or whoever, you know, owes them a lot of money. And now it looks like they can't pay them. They don't understand. That is the intentional end game. Debt, when it comes to a national scale, is always about their after the assets. People have to remember this debt, this quote unquote money. The banks have nothing in this. They simply create it on a computer, and then it's borrowed into existence. So they're not really – while these nations can pay the debt, they're reaping that interest, and they're making money here. And the more debt they can pile on a nation, the better, because their end goal is the assets. You know, we look around here in America – and, you know, you like, say, for instance, sports stadiums, you know, you don't have just simply Cowboys Stadium. You have AT&T Stadium. It's the corporatocracy on display. Imagine having, you know, oh, I'm going on vacation this year. Really, where are you going, Jim? Well, I'm going to Verizon Yellowstone National Park, because that is the end goal here. I'm going to go check out the Goldman Sachs Wilderness area. You know, they're after the assets. This is the end game. This is why they hate it. They recoil at the idea of a nation actually paying their debts off, because it breaks them free of the debt slavery system. Because again, not just individuals become debt slaves, but nations themselves become debt slaves, and they are subject to, they are under control and authority of the lenders. But this is, you know, this is, I just thought it was worth kind of clarifying, so that like, the average listener hears this and they're just kind of, well, it doesn't compute, and then they blow over this point. But Dr. Johnson brings up, this is such a salient and important point to this story, and this is why they react to it so negatively, because again, this is where their control comes from. If you were in hock to these big banks or to the IMF, which I repeat myself, you know, you are under their control. You're under their authority. They reap the interest payments. And then when it reaches the point you can't get the interest payments, they get what they're after in the long term, which is seizing the assets themselves, which is seizing the hard property, the land, the ports, whatever the case may be. And they claim that it's owed to us. But why is it owed to them? Well, it's owed to them because they created some digits on a computer out of nowhere. It is just the ultimate scam. The monetary system in this world is truly the ultimate scam. So, of course, they're going to hate somebody like Orban, who is actually working to break free, you know, get his people and his country to break free of those kind of bonds. This is what it looks like when a leader actually views the people under him, the people he has authority over, as his people, as kinship, and not as simply just commodities that can be replaced with people from other places of the world. They have no loyalty to him. This is what it looks like. And it's not really a surprise that they find, you know, that this is such a threat to these people.
He's certainly the best standard I think there is in Europe as a leader. I mean, it's incredible that he would pay the debt off and then they would junk all his bonds. And Soros would try to buy the whole country and then offer, what was it? He would pay for a million immigrants to come in every year. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just naked, isn't it? What he wants. He just wants to replace all the white people. I mean, Orban is, yeah, he's an absolute hero of a leader for our times, I think.
I keep forgetting, I keep forgetting how much better of a speaker Grandpa is than I am. He what takes me hours to drone on about, he could summarize in 5 minutes. But he got it exactly correct, precisely correct. That's what the Ukrainian revolution was about. That's why they hate. But it's, you know, leadership means the state and the common good is greater than the specific good of bankers and the oligarchs. That's what this is.
Yeah, he's an incredible guy. Grandpa, what have you got for us today? I believe you got something just as different as Viktor Orban and Ernest Shackleton was from what people would be expecting.
Well, So when y'all got in touch with me yesterday, would you like to do a roundtable? You know, sure. What are we going to do? And then I heard what the topics are. And now this isn't really my forte. I try to be kind of funny and, you know, talk about current events and look at things in a big picture and you know, see where everything's going. This isn't my forte. And, we're positive, you know, kind of people with a survival or a heroic story to tell, especially if you talk about people in history. And so I'm thinking, of course, being me, I agree to it anyway. And whether that was smart or not, I don't know. So I'm thinking about this, and we're going to do this show, and we've got Dr. Johnson here who can tell us about, you know, a Russian aristocrat that I've never heard of from the 1700s, everything about their life, and make it interesting. And so I'm sitting here thinking, well, what in the world am I going to talk about today? So I'm sitting around pondering this, and I remember I started thinking about stories that the elders told us when we were kids growing up. And I was thinking about a man named Herman Lehman. And nobody's probably ever heard of this guy. If you jump to your computers and look him up, disregard the Wikipedia page because it's crap. It's about like what Dr. Johnson was saying, the 1999 article about the Antarctic expedition is. I mean, you can skip that. This is an interesting guy, and it is a story about survival. I was thinking about how we used to have, oral history, verbal history. The elders, the older people would tell the younger people these stories. And a lot of virtually everything I'm going to talk about today is coming off the top of my head and just recalling these stories because I've heard these stories about this particular guy growing up. I think it's funny that we've lost that. We have books, but books are going obsolete. Everything's going on the internet. You know, people laugh at cryptocurrency. They say, well, it's not real money. It's just code on the internet. But yeah, we're taking all of our knowledge. We've abandoned verbal history and we're abandoning books and we're putting what? Our history, our stories are becoming nothing more than what? Code on the internet. I don't know. Something about that bothers me. I think I'm kind of old fashioned, but anyway, to get to the story of this guy, a little background, Herman and his brother Willie, they were children. Herman, I believe, was 11. His brother, I believe, was 7. And they were German immigrants, and they came to Texas. And Texas, of course, is to give some context for our European audience, it's huge. All of Great Britain is smaller than the state of Texas. So we talk about a huge geographical area. And these people would come from Europe. You can go through out in the middle of nowhere. You could be traveling out in the middle of nowhere and then come across something and you're looking and it's like you'll see like a church there. And it just strikes you, for instance, that this church is so Nordic in its architecture. Well, then you get to do a little research. And yeah, that's because, you know, a group of Nordic people came and they just spoke Swedish there. Or they spoke Dutch or whatever the case may be. And of course, they brought their architecture from their home countries and they made these little colonies. And the Germans did the same thing as well. In the Texas Hill Country, there were German towns. And Fredericksburg is probably the most well-known German town. And when it was settled by Germans, most of the people there only spoke German. You could wander into that town and the people were very clannish. They were very closed society and everybody spoke German. And in fact, they were so German, I have been told that before the war broke out in the 1930s, they actually flew the swastika on the courthouse flagpole. Obviously, when the war broke out, they told them, y'all better not do that anymore. But that's the context of this story. Back in the 1800s, when it was still wild country here in that area, Fredericksburg type of area. Herman and his family, they were settled down. Well, of course, Indian raids were a common thing. And then the Indians would kidnap children. That was one of the things. When they went on a raiding party, they would kidnap children. They liked to kidnap girls or young women, especially, but they would kidnap boys as well. And Herman and his brother Willie were out in the fields or whatever, and they were kidnapped by a band of Apaches. Now, on the savagery scale, the Apaches are at the top of the scale. The Apache, no other Indian tribe surpassed the Apaches in pure brutality. They make these Islamist groups of today look like pikers. I mean, they were the brutal savage. The Comanche and Kiowa were a close second, but the Apaches were the absolute most brutal. Well, they kidnapped Herman and his brother and took off with them. Well, the cavalry started pursuing them, and they were headed out west. And along the way, the little brother, Willie, he got away from them. In the meantime, while they were camping, before Willie got away, these Indians, they butchered a calf to eat. And because they thought it was funny, they scalped this calf. They cut its scalp off, complete with its ears. And they stuck it on the seven-year-old's head like a hat, just because they thought this was funny. You know, he has his hat with these cow ears hanging down. Well, as they were being pursued by the cavalry, Willie got separated from them. How that happened, there's several conflicting stories, but the most believable I have heard is that he, they just kind of threw him off. It was like, well, he's slowing him down, and kick this kid off. We'll go on without him. The cavalry finds Willie, and Willie refuses to give up the cow hat. The cavalry's like, we found this kid. He's been captured by the savage. Imagine a seven-year-old. He's minding his business out in the field, gets abducted by the most brutal of Indians, and yet he's still sane enough after just a week, which most people would have already lost it by then, that he to the cavalry's like, let's get this off your head. And kid's like, no, this is my cow hat. I'm not giving up my cow hat. And anyway, so Herman stays with the Apaches. He's not so fortunate. And they take him back to their main encampment. And of course, you want to talk about a fight for survival. I mean, this is the real deal. He winds up ultimately surviving. He gets adopted by an Apache warrior. And, he learns to be an Apache, basically. This is his way of surviving. They didn't have, have a safe indoctrination on how to be a true Apache. This isn't the Disney version of quote unquote Native Americans. This is the real, they didn't care if he got killed. In fact, they would probably think it was funny. They would do mean things to him, horrible things to see what he would do. It was just entertainment. But still, he fought and still he managed to survive. Remember, he's 11 years old. This is a kid. He was very fair skinned, very, very pale, very white. It's like me. He had the curse. You don't tan, you just sunburn and peel. And he's out here living with these Indians. He essentially, for all practical purposes, managed to survive by adopting their ways. And he would go on raiding parties, and they would go raid livestock and things such as that. There was a story that this band of Apaches came through and the Texas Rangers got after him. And one of the Rangers remarked, he's chasing this little band of Apaches. And he notices one of them is just pale white, because they don't have no shirts on, they're wearing a breech clout or whatever, basically for all, almost naked. And they jump on their horses, and there they go. And he notices this pale white Apache. He's like, well, that ain't right. And he said, boy, that boy could ride a horse. He thought, I'll catch him. I've got this big, well-bred, grain-fed horse. I'll catch that grass eater. And he couldn't. He outran him. He lived with the Apaches for some time. And then his adopted warrior father figure in the Apache tribe got killed. Had altercations. These Indians would kill each other at the drop of the hat. He wound up killing one of them. That caused even more discontent. These Apaches, they would make alcohol out of anything. They would take juice from cactus and find a way to make alcohol, and they would get drunk. And every time they would get drunk, the topic of conversation always turned to, maybe we should kill the white guy. He'd been living with them for years, but it doesn't matter. I mean, the topic of conversation would turn to, maybe we should kill the white guy. So Herman decides that, I probably better get out of here. One of these days, they're going to get around to killing me. So he slips out of camp, gets a horse, and rides off. He rides up to the panhandle area, I believe. And again, this is a huge distance. He goes up to the panhandle and lives in solitude for years. I mean, he's up there for like a year or two in absolute solitude, never sees another human being. He's just living out there, killing animals, living by himself, nobody to talk to, absolute solitude. Once again, this would make the average person go insane, but he's just out there basically living like an Indian. Well, as he's living up there in solitude, he looks at, he sees a little encampment, of Indians. He's not sure who they are. And he thinks to himself, I'm going to ride down there and see who it is. And if they kill me, that's all right. I just can't stand being out here by myself any longer. So he rides down this little encampment of Indians or Comanches. The Comanches and Apaches were always killing each other. They were very hostile. So he rides down to this encampment of Comanches. I can imagine the look on these guys' face because he rides down to their camp. Here's this pale, sunburnt white dude, absolutely European German guy. And he's wearing the attire of an Apache warrior. I just can't imagine. They were just like, what in the hell is this? And there was, you know, some back and forth. But eventually the Comanches said, yeah, okay, we'll take you in. And in the rest of his time with the Indians was basically spent with these Comanches. And he got along fairly well with them. Once again, doing Indian stuff, going on raiding parties, etc. As that era drew to a close, more and more pressure was put on the Indian tribes to give up their white captives and things. And eventually, Herman was captured for the second time by white people, by the government. He was captured. He didn't want, he wanted to stay with the Indians because at this point, you know, his whole adult life, this is all he knew. But they captured him and they put him in a wagon, started sending him back towards the direction that he come from. An interesting part of this story that I had heard. So they had to basically shackle him in the wagon because otherwise he'd keep running off and trying to go back to the Indians. And he's riding in the wagon, and the cavalry, the army men are discussing. They're like, man, this poor guy, he's been with the Indians so long, he can't understand English. We can't communicate with this guy. What they didn't understand is he never spoke English. He spoke German. The only languages he knew were the Indian languages from the tribes that he lived with and German from when he was a kid. So these guys are trying to talk English. Do you understand me? And he's like, no, I never, you know, he could have never understood them. He never spoke English. It was a completely foreign language to him. Eventually, he was returned to civilization. Needless to say, it was a rough transition back to normal life. One of the stories the old timers told is when they were kids, they said they would walk by his house and old Herman would sit on this porch and he would shoot the kids with bow and arrow. The arrows were blunt, you know, so they wouldn't actually stab them. They'd just leave a huge bruise on them. And he would sit up there and whoop, hit these kids and knock them over. Ah, yeah. And he thought it was great funny. This, it had affected his personality so much, having lived with these people. Among the Apache people, pigs, they wouldn't eat swine. They considered that unclean, you know, and he would show up and they would be having a German. Germans love their swine. Germans love their pork, you know, just find out what head cheese consists of. It's a disgusting German thing. And, you know, they have all this pork out there. And he went off and would, like, flip the tables over. How can you eat? Don't try to get me to eat this stuff. You know, so there was a lot of bit of conflict there. He would show up to state fairs and he liked to wear his Indian garb around. And he would be an oddity kind of put on display. But he survived. He survived returning back to, quote unquote, civilization as much as he did among the Indians. Now, somebody could sit here and hear this story and say, well, yeah, but he became one of them. Yeah, he became, you know, that's something not to think positively about. You know, he essentially became a savage, but he survived. And it was the only way to survive. We live in a world now where you have grown people 20, 30 years old that demand safe spaces because if they read something they don't like on the internet, they say it threatens their safety. Well, if people in their 20s that go to college and demand safe spaces, they go on about microaggressions that, quote unquote, threaten their safety. You look at a man such as Herman Layman, and at 11 years old, gets kidnapped by the most brutal of Indian tribes and manages to not only survive, but to thrive and to keep his, and most importantly, to keep his sanity. Where most people would, even at that time, they would have broken mentally. Yes, he kind of became a savage to survive. But nonetheless, it is indeed a tale of survival.
Did he actually become reunited with his family at all when he was brought back to civilization?
Yes, I believe he was. Of course, you know, I mean, it was like a completely different person. I mean, he's living in this foreign, among these foreign people, these different people, and since he was a child, you know, and then all of a sudden, yes, he's returned to his family, he's returned to the area he came from. But you can imagine, I mean, he's so different. He has nothing, basically nothing in common with his own family. It's a very similar story. The famous Indian chief, Quanah Parker, his mother was a white woman who was kidnapped by the Indians. And she birthed Quanah Parker, who became one of the great Indian chiefs. And when she was an old lady, she was, again, given back as one of the returned captives, and they sent her back to her extended family. But she had nothing in common with them. I mean, she'd spent her whole life with these people. So, yeah, I mean, these people would get returned. But, you know, it wasn't all smooth sailing, for sure.
Yeah, it's funny that when I was hired by Willis Cardo at the Barnes Review in 99, my very first assignment was to put something together on Simon Girty, who up until that point I had never heard of before. It's the identical story that you just told, except in Pennsylvania, and he's an Irishman. So this stuff definitely happened, and he earned the respect of the Seneca tribe by being tough, by getting beaten up and not bending. So that he earned their respect, at least from that physical feat.
What year was this that this happened then, or sort of around about what time, what century? End of the 18th century?
It was
1800s?
It was in the 1800s. There is a book about him. It's called The Last Captive, if you can find it. It's an old book that kind of details better than what I'm. Once again, I'm just kind of going off of memories. These are stories that were told to me as I was a kid. Some of these things, I had to remember them from 30 plus years ago. But no, this was in the 1800s when the Indians pretty much controlled the territory.
Just like a Texan sort of folk tales that the Texans know about, but maybe not outside of Texas.
Well, yeah, and I mean, again, as Dr. Johnson pointed out, this happened quite a bit. Again, these kidnappings, the Indians would kidnap, you know, children. Again, they really preferred to kidnap girls and young women. And one of the reasons is because the Indian females in a lot of these tribes, whether it's just due to the harsh environment, bad nutrition, or probably some inbreeding, would often only be able to bear a child once every 3 to 4 years. They would capture these young white women, and they could bear a child every year. So that's why young white women or even girls were so often preyed upon, so often kidnapped in these raids. But as we've seen in the story here, they would also kidnap boys, young men, boys such as this. Most often they would simply be killed. And as the story Dr. Johnson referenced, if you were just tough enough, then you had a chance of surviving. I just think, again, that it's so interesting when you look at this in the context of the modern world, where people say their safety is they feel threatened just because they read something that they disagree with. And then you have this sort of toughness to where, you know, you're actually, your life is threatened on a daily basis, starting when you're just a kid, and yet you're able to survive.
We need that struggle to bring the best out in us, don't we? I mean, people today, they just, you know, they really don't know how lucky they are to be living in the world that they are. Well, I think that's three really great stories today. I've really enjoyed them. Thank you very much for coming on, Matt. Thank you very much for coming on, Grandpa. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget that we do require your donations to keep the website going, and we have a Bitcoin wallet that is at the bottom of every page. And we will be back with more Radio Albion roundtables for you at some point in the future. So until then, have a great week.
Well, that's the round table.